Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
At every turn, our dean said, when there has been an imbalance of power, the truth questioned, or our beliefs and values distorted, the change required to restore our nation has always come from the bottom up, from our people. As I said, our quote for the day, from the chairman now of the Democratic Committee, Democratic National Committee. Our theme for the day, are we rapidly becoming a big brother society? Welcome to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. In the first hour of our program, we're going to be speaking in just a moment with Ankar Goethe of the Ayn Rand Organization, Ayn Rand Institute. In the second hour of our program, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is Open, is going to be talking to us about the latest frames the Bush administration is using to try to spin public opinion. We're going to be trying to figure out what the significance of the Supreme Court ruling is this morning about abortion. Got kicked back down to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. It may be very little, or it may be very significant. We're trying to find out. Talk about what Walmart is doing in India. But first, Walmart in Maryland having a bit of a problem. The state's legislature on Thursday passed a law passed a law in the state of Maryland that requires all companies with more than 10,000 employees to spend at least 8% of their payroll on employee health benefits. Now, there's four other companies in the state who have more than 10,000 employees. All four of those companies already pay more than 8% of their payrolls on employee health benefits. The only one that doesn't is Walmart. In fact, Walmart specifically, at least according to the anti-Walmart films and campaigners out there, encourages, let's say, I suspect there's a legal significance to that term, so I'm not quite sure how to say this, but let's start over again. Many of Walmart's employees, for whatever reason, end up using the welfare benefits of the state. That is, you and I end up paying for their benefits rather than Walmart paying for them. And the state of Maryland said enough already. If a company can't cover the needs of their employees, they shouldn't be able to employ them. And Ankar Goethe is a senior writer, a senior fellow with the Ayn Rand Institute, where he teaches in the Institute's Objectivist Academic Center. Ayn Rand Institute promulgating the thoughts and teachings and writings of Ayn Rand, who, with her book Atlas Shrugged, really kicked off the Objectivist movement, which has morphed in some ways into the libertarian movement and into the most conservative parts of the conservative movement. A lot of folks, Grover Norquist and others, often quoting Ayn Rand, although I know, Ankar, that you would not associate yourself with these guys who call themselves conservatives.
Yeah, that's right. I think we have a different philosophy than the conservatives, and she definitely did not view herself as a conservative.
Yeah, no, and although I think it's important that we listen to what you have to say, because these guys are looking to your comments and writings, and certainly to hers, for their philosophical foundation. So, what's your take on this? Don't the people of the state of Maryland have the right to define business and how it's conducted in their own state?
No, I actually don't think so. I think this legislation, this law that has just been passed in Maryland, is an immoral law. I don't think the government, whether federal or state, has the right to tell a private business how it should spend its money, and how it has to pay its employees, how it has to compensate them, if it has to give so much in salary, so much in health benefits, so much in dental benefits, whatever. This is a decision of the private business and the employee who joins that business. The people at Walmart are free to take that job or not. We can talk about this a little bit later, but I don't think this legislation helps people at Walmart. It is not aimed to help the employees at Walmart. But
what do you think its purpose was then?
I think its purpose is to try to punish Walmart, not to help.
What if its purpose was simply to stop the taxpayers of Maryland from subsidizing Walmart?
It's not an issue of the taxpayers subsidizing Walmart. Now, I think there's enormous problems in the health care in America today, but that is created by government intervention. It's created by all kinds of regulations that distort market forces in the healthcare industry. If healthcare is viewed as a right, that is, a person, a citizen has a right to healthcare that is going to be provided by the government, which, so you as a citizen view it as, well, the government's giving it to me for free. If that's the premise,
as it is in every industrialized country in the world, except the United States.
And what happens in those countries? The first thing that happens is, if it's a right provided freely by the government, then you're going to consume health care like crazy. I mean, think if the government said you have a right to food, and it's going to be provided freely by the government.
But that hasn't been the experience in these other countries. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I don't look forward to going to the doctor. I mean, maybe you do, and maybe there's a few people who are like surgery junkies or something, but, you know, my idea of a good time is not going and having my prostate checked.
No, I actually think this is what does happen. So the first thing you get is an explosion in people using healthcare, using the most expensive forms of tests. If there was an issue, well, do I need this test or not? Well, if it's free, why not get the test?
But if that's the case, then why is it that we spend twice as much on health care as any other nation in the world, and yet we're in the 20s and 30s when you look at our ranking in terms of quality of life with regard to health care?
But what happens then is that in other countries, I'm from Canada, I've been in this kind of situation. What happens is it's rationalized. It's rationed.
It's rationed here. The Wall Street Journal did a whole series on how healthcare is rationed here. It's rationed by economics. If you're wealthy, you've got it. If you don't, you're screwed.
That is not rationing. If you have to pay for something, that is not. What happens in a place like Canada is you wait in line for 6, 10 months a year, even though you could pay for the test, but you're not allowed to pay for the test or the procedure.
For the elective surgeries. I mean, we've had a number of Canadians, we have a lot of Canadians who listen to this program. I was speaking with Ankar Gatte of the Ayn Rand organization, AYNRAND.org, you know, who call in regularly and say, hey, listen, you know, I live in Canada and I really like it here. And if you have a problem in Canada, you can be seen the same day. You can be seen within hours. I lived in Vermont just a few hours, you know, literally 2 hours from the Canadian border for 10 years, and I don't recall once seeing anybody in my town of Montpelier showing up from Canada looking for a doctor. And yet we were organizing bus tours of people going to Canada to get medication.
Well, I know plenty of people have gone to America to get procedures that they could not get in Canada, or they could not get in a timely fashion. But if we go back to what is happening at Walmart, a company pays an employee what that employee is worth to them. We're in a competitive market. You pay an employee based on the idea that these are the services I'm going to get from the employee.
So you think there should be no minimum wage laws, no child labor laws, no maximum hour work laws, no interference whatsoever by the government in the workplace? As the Supreme Court was ruling back in 1910, 1912, 1913, 1905, it started with the Lochner case.
Yeah, I believe in freedom in the marketplace in every area, including employment. And what happens with something like minimum wage law? Well, the people who the potential employee who is not worth $5, let's say the minimum wage is $5, who's not worth $5, his services are not worth $5.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that there are people in our society who are not worth having enough money to feed their families and pay their rent?
I'm saying that there are people, take a 16-year-old kid whose work at that point in time.
Let's talk about adults here, because talk about adults.
Yeah, I think that, yes, there can be an adult whose services, for whatever reason, he only wants a part-time job, he's devoting most of his life to, say, the acting profession, but he needs to do something else to put some money on the
table. No, you're taking the exception. Let's talk about the rule. We have millions of people, tens of millions of people in the United States who are working at or close to the minimum wage and living in poverty as a consequence of that. You think that's okay?
I think that is the economic reality. And if you think, well, look, this person should have some more money, that is the function of charity. It's not the function of the employer to pay someone $20 an hour when that person is worth $10.
But the employer is just playing the game of business in our society. Don't we as a society have the right to say, hey, you want to play the game of business in our society? We're going to set some rules for you. One of them is you have to do it that the economy serves the people, not the other way around.
No, and that goes back to the issue, is there a right to health care? I think this is a nation of individual rights, where each person has the same rights. It's not for society to come and tell somebody, this is what you have to do.
Why not?
But well, how does the society get that right? Why does it have the right?
Because we collectively come together and call ourselves a society.
Well, but that is not what the American system is. Not a collectivist system. It's not a democracy.
Well, certainly it is. The first three words of the Constitution are "We the people."
We the people delegate certain powers to the government, but the government is there to protect the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And those are individual.
However we define that. Ankar Gatte, it's been a good conversation. I appreciate you taking the time to share with us. Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website. And interesting conversation. We'll have to carry it on one of these days soon. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Got my tonsils out in Taiwan, my gallbladder out in Greece. Took a side trip up to Sweden to fill some caverns in my teeth. Saw a doctor down in Denmark and a specialist in Spain to see what could be causing me this dull but steady pain. Took a trip up to Toronto just to buy some little pills. Thought I'd died and gone to heaven when they handed me the bill. Went to Norway when I noticed that my eardrum had a hole. Got back home just in time to watch the Super Bowl. It's been a brutal year, but man, I'm glad I was overseas, where you can see the doctor when you really got a need. Where people, they live longer, babies also like they should. I guess they call it health care, and I guess they got it good.
I guess so. Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The state of Maryland has said, hey, we're tired of paying for the health care of Walmart's employees. That's the bottom line. Very simple. The people of the state of Maryland got together through their elected representatives and said enough of this already. An employer who has more than 10,000 employees has to pay at least 8% of their payroll on employee health benefits. This really goes to the issue that the billionaire financier Sir James Goldsmith made just before he died in his book, The Trap, where he talked about how conservatives will argue that we, the people, that society is here to serve economy, which is essentially those with wealth, or the economy in general, and that really the radical idea of democracy in the United States is that an economy is here to serve we, the people. And if we're going to define the rules of our economy, if we're going to define the rules by which we interact economically, we have not just the right, but I would say the obligation to say that we're going to do this in a way that is going to optimally affect us, we the people, our culture, our society. And other countries do this, by the way. It's amazing. You got folks like Thomas Friedman running around saying, well, everybody should be like India. Look at this incredible explosion. Wonderful. Isn't India wonderful? And all his examples in his book about India. Well, guess what? As the Wall Street Journal points out today, new headline, Walmart stakes India claim. Ahead of possible market opening, foreign retailers gear up. Walmart is knocking at the door of India, they write, whose billion-person economy is largely untouched by modern retailing, but might soon let foreign competitors into that sector. Their prime minister is talking about changing their laws because right now, 95% of all retail sales in India, 95% are handled by small mom-and-pop shops. Why? Because their law requires it. Their law says that foreign companies, large foreign retailers, cannot come in, and even state-to-state retailers cannot come in. It has to be local businesses. 12 million mom-and-pop shops, newspaper stands, and tea stands provide 95% of all retail sales in India and also provide a decent living to millions and millions of entrepreneurial Indians. Walmart wants to put an end to all of that. And they are over there spending big bucks. As the Wall Street Journal notes, Walmart executives have been among the industry's strongest lobbyists. The company has used executive visits and pamphlets to preach to India's public and political leaders, even those from India's Communist Party, about how international retailers can transform distribution systems and lower prices. Yes, they will lower prices, and they will put all of these folks out of business. They will suck all that money out of that economy, and the Walton family will have more billions in their checking account. And so as the Walton heirs sit on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, which are only taxed at 15% now, courtesy of George W. Bush, and no Social Security taxes paid on it, they will be able to see even more money. Twyla in Canton, Ohio on the line. Hey, Twyla, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Twyla?
I just wanted to make a comment. I think that what Marilyn's doing is a really good idea. I worked for Sam's Club 10 years ago, and which is an affiliate of Walmart,
mm-hmm.
and the health insurance that was offered then was Walmart insurance. It was the worst health insurance on the planet, and basically the company was making money off the employees and calling it an employee benefit.
Well, this was
there was a claim, they would fight any claim. It was horrible.
Yeah,
and they're going to keep treating their employees crappy until somebody makes them not, you know?
Well, and not just Walmart. I mean, let's make this not just beat up on Walmart Day, because this is really the nature of business right across the board. As our guest in the last segment pointed out, you know, businesses feel that they should simply be able to do it any way they damn well please. Twyla, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Michelle in Long Beach, California. Hey, Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. You know, yeah, I was listening to your guest before, and as I told your caller, this is just typical Spingala, if you ask me, this whole, you know, big government. If you look at Medicare right now, the laws that changed it, look what they've done to it to make it so difficult. You can't get pharmaceuticals bids. You know, they can't get bids.
Oh, they put a poison pill in it. The Republicans, when they added the pharmaceutical drug benefit to Medicare, in my opinion, they did it the way they did it, preventing government from negotiating prices in order to destroy Medicare.
Exactly. That's what I was telling. There's another example. Look at No Child Left Behind. Mandate, but don't fund it.
Oh, yeah. You know, yeah, they're trying to destroy our public schools, too, because it's all socialist in their mind.
Exactly.
I mean, there you go. So, Michelle, thanks a lot
for
the call. You're welcome. And this is so much the point. You got to get it that there is a world full of people out there who call themselves conservatives who believe that, you know, we the people have no right deciding how we the people want to live. Instead, it should simply be, they the rich. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
We're so happy when they passed AFTA. We moved all our factories just across the border. We used to pay good wages, now we don't have to. Maquiladora. We'll pay you $50 for a 100-hour week. We'll bribe the inspectors so they can ignore you. You can't use the toilet and you're not allowed to speak. Maquiladora.
Isn't it great?
The taxes in the states were sort of steep. The worker safety laws can really bore ya. Now we're turning out our products on the cheap at the Maquiladora.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number. India getting ready to open up its markets. Yes, the wonders of listening to madmen like Tom Friedman. India getting ready to open up its borders to foreign retailers and essentially eviscerate, a fancy way of saying disembowel, cut the guts out, wipe out, smash, destroy the mercantile middle class of that country by doing so, as has been done in the United States. I'm old enough to remember traveling around the United States and hitchhiking across the country when I was a teenager. These many years ago, more than 30 years ago, and in every city was completely different from the last, and you knew where you were by. It's just every place had a unique characteristic, a unique quality, the cities, the states, and now it's all. I mean, there's like, you know, 25 brands, you memorize them, you can drop down any place in the United States, and it's always the same. It's like, how do you even find your way around anymore? Well, you go from the Taco Bell over to the Walmart, over to the, you know, and it's just, anyhow, you've heard the rant before, so I need not repeat it. Jennifer in Fremont, California. Hey, Jennifer, thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to talk about this canard that people in Canada wait and wait and don't get care, and here we just zoom right in because
I know it's nonsense.
It is. I have an HMO, and we wait for everything. 4 months it took them to treat my husband's kidney stones, 18 months to get my son a psychiatrist, and before we had health care, there was no wait at all because we just didn't get anything.
Hey, we have a health insurance program here where if I want to see any Dr. B, you know, I've got to see Dr. A first, and my Dr. A just fired me.
because I canceled
a couple of appointments. So they said, sorry, we're not going to see you anymore. So now, you know, it's like, I mean, all you talk about, you know, restrictions. We have one of the most restrictive healthcare systems in the United States here, and I've got a good insurance program. I mean, you know, it's crazy.
When I first started out, when we got our very first, genuine healthcare program, it was just in time for me to find out that I had cancer and get it treated.
Oh my!
And if I'd not gotten that job, I'd be dead, you know.
And it shouldn't be that way, Jennifer. Jennifer, thanks so much for calling and sharing that with us.
No problem. Thank you so much.
Yeah, much appreciated. Steve in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program.
What's up, Tom?
Hey, I'm here. What's on your mind, Steve?
Talking about the difference between progressives and libertarians.
Okay.
You know, progressives and libertarians, they both, I've read that, Austrian economics book. And, you know, what they both have in common is that they both understand the corruption that it can occur in government from money and corporations.
And conservatives, I think, by and large, true conservatives understand that as well. That's not a political stamp.
But the difference is that progressives want to improve it by changing laws and making better governments, and libertarians just want to do away with government completely.
Yeah.
Another thing, did you ever read RFK Jr.'s book, Crimes Against Nature?
No, I have not.
Well, in the back of it, towards the end, he talks about how much he believes in the free market. The book itself is about, you know, all the crimes against nature that this administration has done.
Mm-hmm.
And in the back, he's talking about the free market and how he believes in the free market. And at first, this blew my mind because I've always kind of had the philosophy that, you know, there is no real true free market.
Well, yeah, let me give you a headline here, Steve. There is no such thing as a free market. The market itself, I mean, well, there is, actually. A free market, like, you know, David and I are sitting here, and if I said, here, David, here's a stick of gum, and he said, here, Tom, here's a pair of fingernail clippers, we've got a free market. I mean, you know, if we've got, you know, whatever we've got in our pockets and we can swap it between us, that's a free market. But that's it. I mean, beyond that, you know, if we're going to use currency, we're participating in a marketplace that already has rules defined by who defines the currency.
Has some sort of rules and regulations. And so, you know, I read further in it, and he basically, what he talks about is that when he talks about a free market, he talks about how businesses should pay for all associated costs of their businesses that impact the community.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In other words,
yeah.
If they pollute, they need to pay for that. And all
right.
That.
And what we're seeing is, I don't know how it is on a state-by-state basis. I know here in Oregon, for example, that in the 1980s, or in 1980 when Ronald Reagan came into office, about 18-19% of total tax revenues for the state were corporate income taxes. Mm-hmm. Now it's around 5%.
Yeah.
Corporations have succeeded in driving down the percentage of taxes that they're paying, which means that middle-class people are paying more and more, and millionaires and billionaires, when I say the rich, I'm not talking about the guy making $150,000, which is rich to a lot of people, but I'm talking about the millionaires and billionaires. I mean, there's this very small slice of Americans, you know, fewer than a couple hundred thousand people who are absolutely making out like just like bandits in the society.
Let me ask you a question on that note. Do you know of a way to look at your state's corporate income tax returns, or an organization out there that watches that kind of thing?
There's an organization here in Oregon that does it, and I'm sorry, their name isn't even at the tip of my tongue. I would guess that each state – I would talk with the local public interest research group.
Okay.
Oregon has one. I know Vermont had one when I lived in Vermont. It's VPIRG. And I think their website was vpirg.org. But if you go to the – I think just probably PIRG.org – public interest research groups. It's one of the groups that Ralph Nader created. And then find the state one. My guess is that they would have that information. Steve,
right,
thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Mark in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Listen, I wanted to make a comment about the guy from Ayn Rand. One of the reasons we have problems talking to these guys is most of the economics that's taught in schools is really phony. And we have the opportunity to do much more with economics, but when you take a look at the colleges and what they're dealing with, they get into a lot of very fancy math because they can't really be honest about what the real issues are. And I was reading a book by a guy by the name of Harry S. Dent, Jr.
Mm-hmm.
It was Roaring 90s, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was had done extensive analysis of demographics and spending and performance of the stock market relative to that.
Oh, I remember that book. Yeah.
Yeah, and essentially what it proved was, and he was looking at...
He was predicting a crash, was he not?
Yeah, he, mm-hmm. well, he was, and also a boom after that, but
yeah.
he was the most accurate predictor of the 1990s stock market performance, and he based it on demographic information and census information, which really the United States is probably the first country to ever gather that extensively.
Yeah.
And what his work actually showed was demand is probably 3 to 10 times the factor that supply is in
of course, with
the economy.
Of course. Any small business person can tell you that, Mark, and thank you for calling and pointing that out, that you know the reason why people go into business is because they've concluded there's somebody out there who might want to buy this product or there's some demand for this product. And those are the businesses that succeed. People don't go into business because somebody handed them some cash and said, here, why don't you start making widgets? Maybe somebody will want to buy them. I don't think so. Joe in Ramrod, Florida. And you're right. We don't teach economics in this country anymore. And I'm not sure we ever did, but we're certainly not doing a good job of it now. Joe in Ramrod, Florida. Hey, Joe.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
I am great. What's up?
Great. I hope people can actually feel this story, talking about health care. I'm 49 years old. I have 4 beautiful children. I also had over 70 foster children, very active, volunteer, et cetera, et cetera. 4.5 years ago, I got bone marrow cancer and really came very close to dying when finally a medication that helped, it literally saved my life. And what happened was after the 6-month trial was over, I literally could not get this medication. It was over $1,500 a month. We had lost our house, and my wife she's an attorney. And let me tell you, you know, we were successful people, middle class people, and everything just fell apart. And you have no idea what it's like saying goodbye to your children because you can't access the medication on the shelf at the pharmacy down the street.
Yeah.
It's torture, and doing it 3 or 4 times, and I literally did it. And for people who are skeptical, Tom, they could look it up because the Atlanta Journal-Constitution did a 2-page article about my situation and about the people I asked for help and was denied. And that was in August of 2004. It was called The Price of Life. It's an amazing article.
Oh, we're seeing it all over the place, Joe. Right here, right now in Portland, where I'm broadcasting from, there's a little kid who's got meningococcal disease, you know, this the meningitis caused by some bacteria that gets in and inflames the brain. And they're putting cans in stores all over the city to try and pay for the health care for this kid because his single mom doesn't have health insurance and can't afford to pay for his health care. And without it, he's going to die.
Are we still the best nation in the country if we allow people to suffer and die because they can't access medicine? That's my question.
Yeah, and the answer...
Excuse me of being unpatriotic. I don't care.
I don't
think we are. I'm sorry.
No, we've really dropped the ball on this hugely, Joe. You're absolutely right. Thank you very much for the point.
My call,
yep. Good to hear from you, Joe. Appreciate it. Alan in Arlington, Texas. Got about a half a minute left, Alan.
Okay.
What's up?
Tom, enjoy your show. Just a quick comment. Cons are always bashing entitlement programs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think about the times before Medicare. My comment just relates simply to where's the money in insuring old people that are going to become infirm soon.
Oh, there is none. That's why during the Great Depression, when Roosevelt finally passed Social Security in 35 or 37, before Social Security, the leading cause of death among elderly people in the United States in the winter was hypothermia, freezing to death, and in the summer was starvation.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, people were dying.
How's the free market going to fix that?
Well, the free market, yeah, exactly. If you want to know how the free market's going to fix that, go read Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, the story of Ebenezer Scrooge and Bob Cratchit, you know, and the answer is the free market doesn't fix it. The free market exacerbates it. Alan, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it, and you make a great point. 45 minutes past the hour, so Tom Hartman Radio Show.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Time for a conservative alert. Yes, indeed. CNN headline news is signed Glenn Beck, right-wing talk show host Glenn Beck. And as Media Matters for America says, CNN headline news decision to sign Glenn Beck is a slap in the face to the families of 9/11 victims whom Beck has proclaimed he hates, is a slap in the face to victims of Hurricane Katrina, who Beck has called scumbags. And I would add, to a caller who says that he had tortured U.S. prisoners in U.S. custody, he says, I got to tell you, I appreciate your service. On filmmaker Michael Moore, Glenn Beck said, hang on. Let me just tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking about killing Michael Moore, and I'm wondering if I could kill him myself or if I would need to hire somebody to do it. No, I think I could. I think I could. He could be looking me in the eye, you know, and I could just be choking the life out of, is this wrong? And on the father of Nick Berg, the American civilian executed in Iraq, he says, the want to be a better person today than I was yesterday, says he's a dad, but he's grieving, but I don't buy that. I'm sorry, I don't buy it. I think he's grieving, but I think he's a scumbag as well. I don't like this guy at all. Yeah. Shame on CNN. Tragedy. 51 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee on the line. Hey, Bob, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, Tom. I'd like to state why I believe that health care should be a right in the United States and why medical education should be funded by society.
Okay.
You know, throughout history of human existence, for by far the majority of time, health care was a right. The herbologist, who we might call a medicine man, a shaman, or a witch, provided care for all in the society. Not only was this motivated by humane considerations and group solidarity, but also for reasons of collective self-protection.
Right.
You know, were a contagious disease left untreated, the entire group would be in jeopardy.
Sure.
Even the treatment of injuries was a group security consideration.
And it still should be, Bob.
When a midwife, hunter, or gardener became disabled, the entire group suffered. And these considerations are no different for us. People with untreated medical conditions due to the lack of money may spread their infections and interrupt the functioning of society.
Yeah. Bob, you're spot on, although you're reading, and I don't like people doing that on my program. I'm sorry, but I appreciate your call, and I agree with your point. Rob in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rob, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I know we're up against the end of the hour here, so I'll make it quick.
Sure.
We're having a little discussion at our workplace about the health insurance crisis that everyone's facing, and some people are bringing up those health savings accounts.
Right.
And my personal reaction is that anything that the Republicans support has to be a bad idea, but I would want to give them a fair shake at least. And I did some research on them, and while I can see they're bad for the society as a whole in that people who don't have any health care are still not taken care of, how do I convince these people who want to do this in our workplace that it's a bad idea for them? You know, I'm talking about the health savings account.
Sure. If the people in your workplace, Rob, are well paid and they're employed and they're in the, you know, solidly in the middle class of America, the health savings accounts are basically a tax break for upper middle class and very wealthy Americans. And, you know, an opportunity to set aside some income that's not taxed that can be used to pay for the holes in health insurance. On the other hand, if the people in your workplace are the working poor, and I suspect they're not, or they wouldn't be talking about health savings accounts, but if they're part of the, you know, roughly 40-50% of the, almost half of the American workforce who are spending 100% of their paycheck every single week, just on living expenses, just on the cost of getting by, and don't have the option of something like a health savings account, then it's a bad idea because, it's not an option for them. And for all of us in society, it's a bad idea because it further exacerbates the gap between haves and have-nots.
Right. I work in like local government, so we've always had total health care coverage, and now with the crunch, it's starting to be, okay, we want you to start paying something for your health care.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the people are like, well, hey, there's these health care plans.
Yeah, it's just like the voucher thing. It's just like the voucher thing for schools, Rob. You know, the way to destroy public schools, it costs on average in the United States $5,600 a year to educate a child in a public school. And so what they do is they say, oh, we're going to give you a $2,000 voucher, $2,500 vouchers. That's the typical amount that's brought up in most of the voucher legislation around the country, so that you can send your child to a private school. What that means is that people who can't afford the additional $2,500 are, you know, the voucher's worthless to them. And those people who would have otherwise put their child in a private school to begin with are getting a $2,000 discount that's paid for by we the people. And the health savings accounts are not all that different in as much as that tax break that is provided on the medical savings account is being paid for by all the rest of us. So, you know, in a very personal and selfish point of view, it may be a good thing for you. And you should, you know, you all need to be looking at this. But in a societal point of view, as a policy thing, we should be saying, you know, health savings accounts is another Band-Aid on a cancer. What we need to do is we need to completely reform the healthcare system in the United States and completely change it. Rob, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Jerry in Olympia, Washington. We've got about a half a minute. Jerry, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. The Ayn Rand folks, and I never get the pronunciation right, but anyway, they often frost me. And in this instance, this.
But at least they're honest.
Huh? Well,
at least they're honest. I mean, Tom DeLay is thinking the same things. He's just not willing to say them out loud.
But infants are honest. And we don't expect them to have a conscience, but when you're an adult up and walking around using our streets, our air, our sidewalks, you have a responsibility to help out.
Yeah. Well, see, the thing with the folk, the objectivists from, you know, Ayn Rand and others, I mean, it's not just them, but a lot of libertarians, for example, is just like the old Bolsheviks in a way that they are utopianists. They believe that if only, you know, the language always begins with, if only everybody would, and then, you know, fill in the blank, then everything would be great. And I'm sorry, there aren't those absolutes out there. We need to work together as a society, issue by issue, and work things out.
Yep.
If only everybody would work together, right, Jerry?
Yeah.
Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Oh, my goodness. It's, but, you know, I do want to acknowledge the folks at Ayn Rand Institute, because so many conservatives are unwilling to come on this program. And by the way, if there are conservatives out there who represent a point of view on any of these issues, give us a call. We'll put you at the front of the line, because we need to have these discussions. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
The modern conservative, wrote John Kenneth Galbraith, oh, geez, 2 decades ago at least, maybe 3 or 4, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy. That is the search for a superior moral justification for selfishness. Thanks to Workplace Democracy in our chat room for sharing that quote with us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. That's me, pimping of the presidency. We're going to get to this in a little bit later on the program. 4 months after he took the oath of office in 2001, George W. Bush was the attraction, the White House the venue. Jack Abramoff and Grover Norquist billing clients for FaceTime with G.W. Bush. Huge scandal breaking right now over at TexasObserver.org, the Texas Observer publication. But first, Jeffrey Feldman is with us with FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, the editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer. Hey, Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
What are the major frames that you're seeing spinning out right now from the conservatives in the media?
Well, I think that there's a couple. The one you just mentioned, the Abramoff scandal, is a huge one that's breaking. In response to this scandal, which is really about bribing and criminal behavior, every single Republican in Congress is standing up and using the word reform as much as possible. The Republicans want to convince the country that when Republicans are handing each other envelopes full of money on the floor of the Congress, that's about lobbying. And reform, changing the rules that they control that. In fact, that's not what it's about. Democrats, in response, need to talk about crime and punishment, which is what this is definitely about. This is money changing hands. This is dirty politics of the worst order, and the Republicans are out there front, in front, once again, defining this as something that it's not.
Now, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com, the Republicans suggest that contrary to Howard Dean's statement 2 weekends ago that there was not a single Democrat who took any money from Jack Abramoff, that this is all about equal opportunity corruption and everybody's in need of reform. And we have Harry Reid, in fact, coming forward with his reform proposals, saying that nobody on his staff is going to be able to take, you know, lunches and freebies and money and things from lobbyists. To what extent is the Republican frame sticking? That this is something that's endemic to politics, not something that's unique to Republicans.
I think that they've been very effective because they have pumped this idea of reform in general into their media machine, and so it's been repeated an unbelievable number of times in a very short period. And really, I think that Harry Reid, despite being out there with a proposal for reform himself, he has been very aggressive at trying to push this idea of a criminal, that this is crime, that, and then we need punishment and response. He had a great quote the other day in which he said that the idea of having Republicans propose a change in the rules on lobbying was like asking John Gotti, the mafia boss, to see if he could do his best to clean up organized crime in this country. So Reid knows what the issues are, but he seems to be alone right now, and therefore lots of Democrats are going to get drawn into this fray. They're going to feel that if they're not out there with the Republicans proposing reform, then they're going to look like they're part of the problem.
And what they end up doing is simply reinforcing the Republican reform frame and causing everybody to think that this is an equal opportunity program. Let me just play this clip of Howard Dean, because this should have been the Democratic frame, and I want to ask you, Jeffrey Feldman from FrameShop is open as soon as you hear this, whether it was the Democrats who dropped the ball on not getting this thing into the brain of every single human on planet Earth, or at least every American, or whether it was the media. Here's Howard Dean on it.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money, and we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true. I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth, and they have misled the American people, and now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
And the Democrats are not involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, it's Dean made a great statement there in his interview with Wolf Blitzer. The one thing that I believe that could possibly be holding Democrats back in response to that was that Dean framed it in terms of Democrats versus Republicans instead of just making this about the American Congress, which is really what the issue is here. I mean, this is a crime scandal that is taking place in the American government, and these people that are involved in this need to be treated as criminals irrespective of party affiliation and gone after in that way.
But Dean's position is the criminals are all the Republicans.
The criminals are all the Republicans, but I think that what happens is that you get a certain amount of fatigue that people, a lot of people in the country who don't follow politics on a day-to-day basis hear that there's a scandal, hear that it's about money, and their response is, this is what big government, this is what, you know, what our politicians do. And they need to be spoken to in really, really basic terms, that this is about crime in the American government that affects everybody.
Why, it's, you know, asking the question, why would Howard Dean's primary frame, which is, hey, it's Republicans who are corrupt, not us Democrats, be different from the frame that some Democrats are using? Oh, there's corruption in Congress, we all need to clean it up, we have a better way of cleaning it up than the Republicans do. Why would that be the difference? It seems to me that the main reason why would be that Howard Dean represents the progressive faction of the Democratic Party, and those in the DLC really don't want the corporate money to go away, because the DLC will cease to exist without corporate money. And so you've got a bunch of DLC Democrats from Joe Lieberman to Evan Bayh out there who really would rather say, okay, let's do systemic reform so that we can make sure that there are still some holes through which corporate money can leak into our coffers.
Yeah, it's a routine that that both parties used very effectively in response to the McCain-Feingold attempt to reform financing in elections, that people jumped on a very general reform bandwagon, which just put more and more large loopholes into the system rather than actually attacking the problem at its roots.
Now, you talk about phony baloney over at frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey Feldman, what are you talking about?
Phony baloney. It's these events that Bush sets up where he goes out into the public and he poses in front of a staged audience to answer so-called questions. It's really remarkable that despite the fact that there have been a number of scandals where the press has discovered that in supposedly unscripted conversations between the president and members of the military, members of the public, yet again the White House puts the president in front of an audience that is fed questions that the president then responds to. This latest one was in Louisville, Kentucky last week, in which the president really, in some instances, he was answering, he was posing the questions before they were even asked by members of the audience. At one point, they had a 7-year-old boy, I believe it was, who stood up and asked the question, "Mr. President, what can ordinary citizens do to contribute to the war on terror?" And the White House puts these events out in order to create the type of photo ops that they want. To run ads that are going to attack the Democrats of being so supposedly weak on terror and use them to intimidate anyone who speaks out against the Iraq war.
Yeah, you point out one of the questions. Mr. President, when will you attack the media?
Yeah. You know, I mean, this idea that an ordinary American citizen would stand up and say, "Mr. President, we believe that you are right and we'd like you to bring to task newspaper reporters who are questioning your policies." It's just preposterous that someone would have that question.
Well, maybe if they watch enough Fox. I mean, you know, keep in mind you've got Bill O'Reilly and out there. I mean, not with any ambiguity. I mean, you know, coming right out and saying
those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Exactly.
Because they, you know, they're undermining everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so, you know, it's not inconceivable, I suppose, if somebody was enough of a junkie of that stuff. But, you know, some of these questions. So you're suggesting that the Democrats should start replying to these by saying it's phony baloney?
Yeah, I mean, we need to draw attention, as always, to the extent to which the president is completely isolated from the American public.
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge problem. In Al Gore's speech just the other day, he talked about this radical change that's going on in the executive branch, where the president is essentially attempting to make the Congress, one-third of our government, completely irrelevant from anything that goes on. Congress, the representatives of the people.
While he stacks the judiciary.
That's right, already stuck to judiciary. I mean, this example of these staged events, completely phony, is an example of where the president displaces his own communications and propaganda machine.
This is not that different from what the Soviet Union, I mean, this is Khrushchevian, or this is Stalin-esque.
Exactly. I mean, these are techniques that are foreign to the United States.
Yeah. So our best strategy, Jeffrey Feldman from frameshopisopen.com, to combat them?
Draw attention to how phony that they are. That really is the best way to go about it.
Phony baloney. Point out the phony baloney of George W. Bush. People asking these questions. It just incredible where Bush's answers even get, "Mr. President, how can we help freedomize the world?" Give me a break. Jeffrey Feldman with Frame Shop is open. And be sure you put it in the is open part, .com. Frameshopisopen.com. But Jeffrey, thanks a lot. Good talking with you today.
Thanks, Tom.
Keep up the great work. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
My SUV is bigger than yours. I don't mess around when I hit for the store. Got a bigger motor, bigger seats, bigger flow for my big fat feet. Bigger windows so I can see all the tiny little people in front of me. When I need to park, no need to worry. Got bumpers to blue, small buildings in a hurry. Environment, don't make me laugh. Now you give a damn about a tank of gas. My wife wants the keys when she goes to the bank. She says it feels like it's driving in a tank. I guess what I'm getting at, you might say, is bigger is better in the USA.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news. Welcome back to our program. Did you know that Yahoo is now tracking group members? They've updated their privacy
whatever you call it, privacy policy. You can see it at privacy.yahoo.com/privacy. And if you belong to any Yahoo groups, be aware that Yahoo is now using web beacons to track every Yahoo group user. This is from rents.com. Similar to using cookies, but allows Yahoo to record every website and every group you visit, even when you're not connected to Yahoo. Well, this is interesting. And your ability to opt out of it is not user-specific. It is machine-specific. This means you'd have to opt out on every computer and browser you use. I find that very strange. I wonder if that might have something to do with Yahoo's stock tanking yesterday. I think the conventional wisdom is their stock tanked because their earnings weren't all that great. Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. with us. Hey, Greg, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
It's Big Brother Tom all over again.
Yeah, it really is.
It's 1984. George Orwell knew what he was talking about, didn't he?
He did. Have you read the book?
I have. You know what, Tom? I read it in high school as part of a curriculum, and then I went back and reread it probably 4 or 5 years ago, and I was amazed at how much I had forgotten about the book initially and how on track it was. If you have a little bit of an imagination, you realize a lot of that stuff is going on and probably will continue to go on.
Oh, it's an absolutely amazing book. The last time I was in Australia, it was like two and a half, three years ago, I was doing a speaking tour of four cities in Australia, and I took Orwell's 1984 with me because I, like you, I hadn't read it since I was in high school. And in fact, in high school, I'm not sure I actually read the book. I think I might have done the Cliff Notes version, you know. But I knew broadly what was in it. But I thought, okay, you know, it's time to actually read this thing. And I got about three quarters of the way through it, and it's such a dark book.
It is.
That I had to stop reading it because I was, you know, between the time zone changes, which causes your sleep to have, at least for me, it causes me to have just vivid, vivid dreams. And I was having these vivid Orwellian, no pun intended, nightmares. And I had to stop reading the book and pick up, you know, some, you know, light, you know, science fiction or something like that that would recalibrate my brain, you know, because it was either that or start taking sleeping pills. I mean, when I got back from that trip, I finished it up and boy, George Orwell had a time machine, I'm telling you.
That's right.
So anyhow, what is happening in Washington?
Well, what's going on? There are two big things happening. One, like you and I talked yesterday, I was at the court again this morning. There was another big decision today, not on what was actually decided, but on the fact that it was decided with Sandra Day O'Connor still on the court. And that was the Ayotte v. Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. And that's really the case of the minors needing parental notification if you want to have an abortion. It was a unanimous ruling. And in essence, what the court did is they sent it straight back to New Hampshire and said, you need to rewrite the statute. It said that the appeals court was wrong to strike down abortion restrictions in New Hampshire, and you know, this is probably the last written decision from Sandra Day O'Connor. I actually heard today there may be a few more decisions on Monday, but you know, this is her last one. She wrote, "Everyone joined." You know, in essence, you know what she said is that we are not revisiting any abortion precedents. You know, this is all about, you know, this one case in New Hampshire. And also, what the court has done is they have, you know, what we were talking about in the briefing room, they actually wanted to have all these decisions made while O'Connor is still on the court.
Right.
Because if Alito were, well, you know, if and when he's confirmed, and there were no decisions, they could have reheard all of these arguments, including, you know, this case today and the Oregon assisted suicide from yesterday. So these are on the books, and they're done, and Alito will start with a fresh slate.
Assuming that he gets in. I am still encouraging people to call 888-355-3588, toll free, and ask for your senator, both of your senators. Call both of them. If it's a Republican, tell them to not go along with their party and vote this right-wing crank into the lifetime position on the Supreme Court. And if it's a Democrat, tell them to go for a filibuster. And I'm just horrified to discover that Ben Nelson of Nebraska yesterday, is it Ben Nelson? No, it's Mr. Nelson in Nebraska, anyway, said that he's going to come out in favor, the Democrat is going to come out in favor of Alito.
Of Alito. I mean, you know, it's unfortunately we here in Washington have kind of been hearing for really ever since almost the second day of the hearings that this was a done deal. Obviously, it was going to be how many Democrats would vote for Alito, how many would vote against him, and obviously most Democrats now see that it's a done deal. They still may vote against him, obviously not.
I still think we need to fight it. Even when you lose a fight, if you fight, you gain strength. This is the lesson that the Republicans know so well. They fought and fought and fought for 25, 30 years, and they finally ended up with the whole enchilada. And just rolling over and keeping your powder dry is the most absurd notion. It's you may lose some battles. Eventually, you win the war as long as you engage in every battle. So, anyhow, Greg, I'm wondering if the pimping of the presidency, Jack Abramoff and Grover Norquist billing clients for FaceTime with G.W. Bush that broke in the Texas Observer today is making its way to Washington, D.C.?
Well, that's right. And the White House won't really confirm who actually sat with Abramoff and who didn't. They're, you know, obviously they're worried about it. And, of course, that's the other big story is that now their Democrats and Republicans are both trying to reform their agendas, and they're trying to make sure that there are no more lobbying mishaps like there was
In their dreams. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I love my country so much, man. Like an exasperating friend. Dum 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 dum.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Good old Ricky Santorum. He's out there. I tell you, sometimes you just wonder what's going on with these guys. It's just, you know, what are they thinking? What are they thinking? I mean, here's Senator Santorum denying that his Tuesday K Street Project meetings, his meetings every Tuesday on the K Street Project. Keep in mind, the K Street Project, K Street is the street in Washington, D.C. where all the lobbyists have their offices. And the K Street Project, in its essence, was a program that was designed to say to the lobbyists, hey, if you want to walk into my door, you better fire all the Democrats on your staff. Because I only talk to lobbyists who hire Republicans. And so yesterday, or today actually, Ricky Santorum says, claims the K Street Project has not been about putting pressure on people to hire individuals. We never did that. We don't do that, and we wouldn't do that. Yeah? Well, let's take a listen here. There's a question.
About the K Street Project and to what extent Republicans encouraging Republican staffers to be part of the lobbying culture and lobbyists to come and talk policy, et cetera, has led to this problem, and what remnants of that ought to be, you know, banned or tightened?
Well, I could just say with respect to what I've been involved in, I think it's vitally important from the standpoint of getting our message out to talk to people who talk to our constituents all over the country. To me, it's important to make sure your message is delivered. If you're going to affect public policy in a positive way, you've got to get your message out, and that's certainly one aspect, and that's what the project that I've been involved with has been about, period, is making sure that that we're able to get our message out. This, unlike maybe some other projects around, including projects run by the Democrats here in the Senate as well as the House, it has not been about, you know, putting pressure on people to hire individuals. We never did that. We don't do that, and we wouldn't do that. We're talking about just doing the job of making sure that our message of what we're trying to be communicated is out there.
Yeah, right. And then you go back and you look what was going on. You know, the underlying themes, this from Santorum, quote, the underlying theme was to place Republicans in key positions on K Street. Everybody taking part was a Republican and understood that that was the purpose of what we were doing. Excuse me, this is Rod Chandler, retired congressman and lobbyist, who participated in the Santorum meetings. He said it's been a very successful effort. So here we have Santorum saying, no, we'd never have anything to do with hiring people. And then retired Congressman Rod Chandler, of course. The underlying theme was to place Republicans in key positions on K Street. Everybody taking part was a Republican. And now we get to the pimping of the presidency. 4 months after he took the oath of office in 2001, this is the title of the article from the Texas Observer. Just broke today, texasobserver.org. The Pimping of the Presidency, subtitle, Jack Abramoff and Grover Norquist Billing Clients for FaceTime with G.W. Bush. 4 months after he took the oath of office in 2001, this is by Lou DuBose, President George W. Bush was the attraction and the White House the venue for a fundraiser organized by the alleged perpetrator of the largest billing fraud in the history of corporate lobbying. This has to do with both Jack Abramoff and Grover Norquist, his organization Americans for Tax Reform, which he started in 1985. And, in fact, here's a picture of a check
from the Coushatta tribe of Louisiana to Americans for Tax Reform for $25,000, and this was apparently for a meeting with George W. Bush. Initially, since we first reported this, I'm reading from the Texas Observer, this article that just came out today, the TexasObserver.org. Since we first reported the White House ATR, Americans for Tax Reform, that's Grover Norquist's group, fundraiser, and the $1 million contribution to the Capital Athletic Foundation, that's, you know, one of Jack Abramoff's fronts, shall we say. The Coushattas, speaking through Austin attorneys at Hans, Scarborough, Wright, Ginsburg, and Brusselow, and through Louisiana political consultant Roy Fletcher, have vociferously denied that tribal chairman Poncho visited the White House after contributing $25,000 to Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist's group. They also denied the $1 million contribution to Abramoff's foundation. Recently, the story has changed, or at least the version told by the majority of the controls of the council has begun to change. Two minority members of the five-seat council, the tribal council, have pointed to the pay-for-play meeting with President Bush and the $1 million contribution to Abramoff as examples of the council's fiscal mismanagement. Hey, they go on to say Chairman Poncho recently revisited that issue of his visit to the White House. He had to look at it again. He previously denied it because he was responding to press inquiries that implied he had a one-on-one meeting with Bush. And now it turns out it wasn't just a one-on-one meeting. There were a bunch of other people in the room. He now recalls that he did, in fact, go to the White House on May 9th, 2001. Tribal attorney Catherine Fowler Van Hoof went with him, although she did not get into the meeting with the president. That meeting lasted for 15 minutes, about 15 minutes, and was not a one-on-one meeting. At the meeting, Bush made some general comments about Indian policy, but did not discuss Indian gaming. Abramoff was at the meeting, for which he charged the Coushatta tribe $25,000. And they go on to note, Norquist has not responded to inquiries about using the White House as a fundraiser. It is, however, a regular practice of ATR, Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, to invite state legislators and tribal leaders who have supported ATR anti-tax initiatives to the White House for a personal thank you from the president. The White House for sale. I'm sorry, it may sound like I'm being some kind of political prude. But I really think I'd rather have a president having sex with a consenting adult who's not his wife than have a president having money relationships in exchange for upfront. I mean, this being bribed, you know, selling FaceTime. I mean, this guy's paid a whole lot more, I guess, than Monica Lewinsky did. Norquist recently wrote to the tribes who paid to attend White House meetings. His story regarding that event is also evolving, notes the Texas Observer. The contributions he told tribal leaders in letters that went out in May were in no way related to any White House event. That's what they said then. That doesn't square, however, notes the Texas Observer, with the paper trail Abramoff and Norquist left behind, which makes it evident that they were selling access to the president. They wrap up the story by pointing out that the White House press office has not responded to our questions about other visits Jack Abramoff may have made to the White House or about Norquist using the official residence of the president to raise funds for Americans for Tax Reform. None of the political contributions Abramoff insisted the tribes make as yet have been returned. And the White House is just absolutely stonewalling on this. Back on January 5th, we go back a couple of weeks ago, Scotty McClellan, question. Any update on the Abramoff visits to the White House beyond the three parties that he attended? McClellan, well, I indicated yesterday I think there were a few staff-level meetings, I'm making sure that I have a thorough report back to you on that, and I'll get to you hopefully very soon. You get this? Scotty McClellan on January 5th says about Jack Abramoff selling FaceTime with the president. Isn't it ironic after what happened with Bill Clinton that they're calling this FaceTime? Anyhow, that Jack Abramoff selling FaceTime with George W. Bush, that Scotty McClellan says that he's going to get a thorough report to the reporters on January 5th. Yesterday, a little different. Question. specific staff. You were going to get back to us about the specific staff, Mr. McClellan. Yes, my understanding from the check that we did was that there were just a few staff-level meetings in addition to those. Question, who was in the staff meetings? Mr. McClellan, I don't get into discussing staff-level meetings. It's called stonewalling. And why? Well, in all probability, he looked into it and discovered, oops, we have been selling FaceTime with George Bush and selling it for fairly high prices. Norquist, Abramoff making millions off pimping George W. Bush. I mean, we already know about this. I mean, this is like not some kind of secret. USA Today writes, in President Bush's first 10 months, GOP fundraiser Jack Abramoff and his lobbying team logged nearly 200 contacts with the new administration as they pressed for friendly hires at federal agencies and sought to keep the Northern Mariana Islands exempt from the minimum wage and other laws. Okay, and that was back in June of 2005. No, May 6th of 2005. Sorry, I can't do dates here. And Bush personally met with Abramoff during his presidency. This from the Texas Observer. Abramoff was so closely tied to the Bush administration that he could and did charge two of his clients $25,000 for a White House lunch date and a meeting with the president. From the same two clients he took to the White House in May of 2001, Abramoff also obtained $2.5 million in contributions for a nonprofit foundation he and his wife operated. Don't you think that we have a right to know who the people are who Abramoff and Norquist have been selling FaceTime with George W. Bush are? What was discussed? I mean, doesn't George W. Bush work for us? Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. In Bush world, he's the leader, he protects us, and we're just the peons. That's right, trickle-down economics, we're the peons. And you just have to keep that in mind, right? I really think that we are a democratic republic. We need to go back to it. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
The boss is in the red box picking up his dough while the poor coal miner's down below. He can't buy the groceries and he can't pay the rent, but he's working like the devil for his last red cent. Gone, gone, they're almost gone. The old folks are running out of words to say. Oh, gone, gone, they're almost gone. And the radio's taking their song away.
There you go. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, coming up on it shortly here. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check out our mailbag here.
You know it's nice when the postman has a letter in a sack for you.
Yes, indeed. We get email. And messages on our message board as well.
No matter if it rains.
There's just a few to share with you here. This from Rachel, who signs it, an avid listener to you on 1090 AM. I'm assuming that's KTPK in Seattle. She says, I last wrote to you to find out about a book. I finally purchased Joe Trento's book on the CIA Prelude to Terror, The Rogue CIA and the Agency and the Legacy of America's Private Intelligence Network. He was a guest on your program last summer. Well, so she starts reading Joe Trento's book, right? And she says, well, in talking about George Herbert Walker Bush's involvement, and she adds, the book is dynamite. On page 85, he had this to say, and then quoting from the book, from Joe Trento's book on the CIA, Prelude to Terror, that George Herbert Walker Bush and the CIA set up a spying operation against American politicians before the 1980 presidential election. End of quote. Then Rachel says, like father, like son, thought you may want to mention this on your program, as so much of this current news is about spying. Yeah, and this is the thing. I am absolutely convinced that there is something, that one of the things that George W. Bush is covering up is that his spying, his domestic spying, that he has been unwilling to take to a court and get warrants for, has a political subtext to it. Here's another one. This is from John in San Antonio. He says, over the past year, I've taken your advice on contacting my senators and congressmen. Of course, form letters are the reply in most instances, but my congressman, Henry Bonilla of San Antonio, his offices are just around the corner from my home, sent me a hand-signed letter regarding my concern about Able Danger. He replied that, quote, truth is needed in the current environment, end quote, and thanked me for my knowledge on the subject. I just wanted you to know that your power as an author and commentator and historian can help people realize their power by reminding them daily, as you do, to, and then John put this in all caps, contact their representatives by phone and mail. He says, I never did this before listening to you. A flood of phone calls is powerful. Today I contacted moderate Republican senators, my senators, and my congressmen for the second time regarding spying and the Constitution of the United States. I hope others will as well. We are in a crisis. Thank you, John. I got to tell you, we've got the smartest listeners on the planet listening to this program. Here's another one. This is from John in Grand Rapids. And he says, I know you have roots in conservative West Michigan, so I thought you'd like to hear some recent developments on the progressive front. About 18 months ago, a group of women got together and formed the Progressive Women's Alliance. In a short time, they've grown to 700 paying members, brought Molly Ivins and recently Robert Kennedy to Grand Rapids, supporting candidates and supporting progressive causes. Inspired by the women, a few of us old men formed the Men's Alliance for Progress. Our first meeting was in November, and we drew a couple hundred to hear former chairman of the Kent County Republican Party describe why he is a progressive. He was joined by our current mayor, George Hartwell, who is a Democrat, telling about his progressive beliefs. We are bipartisan and intend to support or sponsor candidates who believe in a progressive agenda. For more on our groups, you can go to progressivewomensalliance.org or wmmap.org. John wraps this up. He says, it turns out George Bush was right about one thing. He is a uniter, not a divider. He has united local Republicans and Democrats against his insane politics. I thought you'd be proud of conservative old Grand Rapids. I am, John. Thank you very much. And finally, Steve, he says, I just finished calling the four senators you talked about that are standing in the way of a filibuster. I was well received by all four offices, despite not being from their states. He says, I also called my senators, Cantwell and Murray. Both said they have not yet decided. I took that to mean that they are gauging the public support. They did say the phones are ringing a lot. This thing is not over yet. Thank you, Steve, for that note. And so many more. I'll tell you, the folks in our chat room and the folks in our message board and all the comments that we're getting, you know, broadly. Yes, there is, this thing with Alito is not over yet. And let me just remind you once again, the toll-free number for Congress. Write this down, keep it someplace, and call it at least once a week. It's part of our collective obligation as citizens of this great republic, is to call toll-free 1-888-355-3588. 888-355-3588. And if you don't know who your congressman or congresswoman is, each one of us has one member of the House of Representatives and two senators. Each state has two senators, so you have two senators, and they represent the entire state. And then you will have one member of Congress who represents your particular congressional district. And a lot of people don't know who their member of Congress is. Nothing embarrassing about that. That's actually, you know, a fairly common thing in America. You know, people sort of pay attention. And if you don't know who your member of Congress is, when you call that number, 888-355-3588, you're going to get the Capitol Hill operator and simply tell that operator, and by the way, they're actually still using people in the United States to answer the phones. Isn't that nice? When you get that Capitol Hill operator, tell them your zip code, and they will be able to quickly look it up and tell you who your member of Congress is, and then you can simply say, okay, please connect me with that person's office. But with regard to Alito, it's the Senate. The House of Representatives doesn't get to confirm presidential nominations to the courts. The Senate does. So you have two senators. Give them both a call. If you have if you're calling a Democratic senator, then say my suggestion would be what I would say and what I have said to my senators, to my Democratic senator, is please support a filibuster. This man should not be on the Supreme Court. If you have a Republican senator, as I do as well, I got Gordon Smith here in Oregon. If you have a Republican senator, call and say please break with your party and vote against Alito. The future of American democracy is at stake here. This guy is not a Republican. He is not a conservative. He is a right-wing extremist, and he should not be on the Supreme Court. Or at least that's my opinion. Anyhow, we'll be back. We're going to have a little interesting conversation here in the next hour about all these comments recently that are being spun by the press hysterically by Hillary Clinton and Ray Nagin and all this stuff, as well as your calls and more. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 6 minutes past the hour. Joe Madison is back with us, joemadison.com. A Black Eagle radio show in Washington, D.C., Joe Madison, recognized as a human and civil rights activist, abolitionist against slavery in Africa, television commentator, columnist, lecturer, labor and corporate spokesman, musician and athlete. JoeMadison.com is website. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm sitting here trying to convince my wife to give me an extra turkey sandwich, but she runs this place like a plantation. So.
Oh, how dare you use that word, Joe!
She said one at a time.
There you go. You know, there's actually a couple things I wanted to talk with you about. One is your efforts to get divestment in the Sudan, and let us not forget to get to that. But first, I wanted to get your take on this. This is Ray Nagin's comments about New Orleans becoming a chocolate city. Senator Clinton using the word plantation. Nagin, you know, clearly, you know, open mouth, insert foot at a certain level. I think, you know, frankly, from my point of view, he's talking about what God wants.
Oh, right? Yeah, that one. He did have to apologize. I didn't know if that was Ray. We refer to him as Ray Ray. Mayor Ray Ray.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because let me tell you, I mean, if that wasn't a Pat Robertson kind of comment or a Pat Robertson moment, but it was interesting because Martin Luther King Day, when we last talked, matter of fact, it was everybody's trying to sound like Martin Luther King.
Right.
You had Ray Nagin, who tried to be a little bit of a preacher, a little bit of a civil rights activist. The reality is that his political base was predominantly white New Orleans, and New Orleans has never been known as Chocolate City. Look, I live in the town that historically musicians used to refer to Washington, D.C. as Chocolate City, and at best right now it's probably Chocolate Chip. But the reality is that that was hyperbole. He knew better. He's probably trying to appeal to a group of constituents that had attacked him about a week ago, and you hit it. He opened his mouth, stuck in his foot, opened his mouth, pulled out his right foot, and then stuck his left foot in when he started talking about God punishing America with hurricanes. So, you know, that's why Martin Luther King was political, but not a politician.
Mm-hmm.
And Nagin just was, at best, I think we could say it was pandering.
But there has been kind of a diaspora. I mean, there has been a great departure from New Orleans, primarily of African Americans, because those were the communities that were the most hard hit and are still wiped out. I mean, that's where the a lot of the bulldozing of houses and things
are going. Well, that's absolutely true.
To some extent, don't you think he was just saying, hey, come on home?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing to say is that, look, he finally did say it, we want everybody to come home.
Yeah.
And guess what? We're not going to leave behind the least of these. We're not going to leave behind any of the people that Martin Luther King would have represented. And so we're asking for all of you to come home. But you got to understand, again, it was hyperbole. I'm certain he was trying to pander to the black constituents who were angry at him because they did not see the plans for Ward 9.
Right.
And it's a politician trying to sound like a civil rights activist, and there's very few of them who can get away with it. Marion Barry might be one, but Marion Barry used to be the president of SNCC. He came out of the civil rights movement.
Yeah, I've met Marion Barry. He's got
Coleman,
a presence.
The late Coleman Young of Detroit may have been one, and the Richard Hatchards of the world. But these are individuals who came out of the movement, quite honestly, you know, Mayor Ray Ray came out of the business community, mm-hmm. and when I went to Houston, Tom, and met and talked with thousands of the people who were homeless, who were evacuees. If Ray Nagin had walked through that Houston Convention Center or the Astrodome, they probably would have booed him. Now that's another story, because he was not that popular in Ward 9 to begin with. So this was pandering. Now,
but the bottom line here, Joe Madison, is, you know, Ray Nagin has been through hell and back,
Yes, he has.
And
been.
so have the people of the city of New
and
Orleans.
So have
and
the
so let's
of
let's
the
cut
the
them all some slack,
Orleans,
shouldn't
black
we?
Black and white.
Right. And so I think we should be cutting them all slack. What I'm most curious about your take on is the media spin on this thing.
The what?
This is the whole media spin on this thing. I was just amazed to see all the TV cable shows, everything, you know, back to back, wall to wall about Hillary Clinton using the plantation word
and Ray Nagin
and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, this is, you know, why all this hype around this stuff? What is this, beat up Democrat Day?
Let me tell you something. First of all, you know, they ought to back up and get a life. First of all, it was she was speaking figuratively. Now, isn't it interesting that she used the word plantation about Congress, speaking figuratively, and at the same time, we refer to the leader of the party as a what? A whip.
You're right.
Now, I can come up with there are a lot of symbolisms up there. So yeah. Tom DeLay used to be the whip, and, of course, he had a deputy whip. And, by the way, what was one of Tom DeLay's symbols when you come to his office?
The hammer.
He had a whip.
Oh, the whip. Okay.
He had a whip. So it was a figurative statement. It was a statement. But you know what? The Democrats ran it like a plantation. How many times have we used that term figuratively and not literally? So why the media would simply do this is because she was talking to an African-American audience, race sales. There she was with Al Sharpton. There she was in Harlem. And she had a little twinkle in her eye when she said, it runs like a plantation. Mm. And you know, matter of fact, you African-Americans know what I mean when you have very little freedoms. Now, in the House of Representatives, for people who don't know this, if you are the minority party, you don't have much say over anything. Matter of fact, you have to get permission from the Republican leadership to even reserve a hearing room.
Yeah.
If you want to have a reception, you can hardly get a piece of legislation introduced, but that's not the rules of the Republican Party as much as it is the rules of the House of Representatives. But there are people in the Democratic Party who have long complained that part of the problem has been the way that sometimes bills are introduced on the floor late at night without little debate, without much consideration to the bipartisan approach towards legislation. And so her comments were figurative.
And it was not meant
to be literal. And before we get all upset, then why in the world does the majority party leader is called the whip? There's a lot of symbolism.
We should just leave it at that. We have Joe. We just have a minute or so left, and I just, you know, what's going on with your Sudanese divestiture?
Well, what's going on? I should tell you is that we're stalled, unfortunately, because we had great success with New Jersey, Illinois, some success in California, and the way it boils down is this. There is something like billions of dollars. I forget the exact amount, but we're talking billions of dollars of state pension fund, Republican, Democrat, black, white, liberal, conservative, money invested in a country that is guilty of genocide as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And this is public money. And so what we've asked state legislators to do is go online. You can go on my website and pull out the legislation that was passed in New Jersey and Illinois to divest any state pension from until genocide ends in Sudan, and universities can divest endowment funds and should.
Amen. Well said. And folks can get to that by going to joemadison.com, and it's working today. It's up and running.
I told them you couldn't get it. They jumped right on it, Tom.
Joe, thanks a lot. Great talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
The fact is that they tell you lies. Things get different names, like oil becomes democracy. The fact is that they tell you lies. They get different names, like collateral damage.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our program. The government is spying on us, says the ACLU. Yeah, the stodgy old American Civil Liberties Union. People portray them as left-wingers, although a lot of left-wingers portray them as right-wingers. You know, they defended the rights of the Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois. They've defended Christmas scenes when they thought it was appropriate, that it was First Amendment speech. On the other hand, they've attacked them when they thought that it was a violation of the First Amendment. The ACLU, absolutely true to their principles, which are, they're all about the First Amendment, freedom of speech and association, very clearly laid out in the Constitution of the United States, particularly in the First Amendment to the Constitution. And the ACLU has filed a Freedom of Information Act, as have others. This is one of the ones that I find the most interesting. The group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, which, by the way, I was a speaker at one of their very early, I believe, one of their founding meetings back in 1980 or 81. Anyhow, PETA has been spied on by the FBI. They filed a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, and they got back all these documents that are, you can see them over on the website of the ACLU at aclu.org. And here's some of the comments about why PETA was being spied on. Suspicious activity with a nexus to international terrorism. They collect money from federal employees for their DT objectives. You know, DT, domestic terrorism. PETA hires interns from Asia and other locations for the sole purposes of committing criminal acts. I mean, these are some of the allegations that have been made. Another group, the Catholic Workers Group, also advocates of a communist distribution of resources. Oh, I see now. So anybody who advocates a communist distribution of resources, what is a communist distribution of resources? Take from the rich and give to the poor? The last I looked, that's how the Republicans are characterizing Social Security or unemployment insurance or Medicare. Well, the Catholic Workers Group was advocating something like that. That earned them the wrath of the FBI. Domestic terrorism, People for Ethical Treatments of Animals, the source will attend this convention. Interns with PETA suggests, and then it's redacted, material support and resources to known domestic terrorist organizations. It's incredible. It's incredible. The ACLU, on behalf of a number of organizations, PETA, Greenpeace, and others. I mean, you got people who are out there, speaking out against the use of lab animals and fur and factory farming. Yeah, terrorists. And Bush running around saying, oh, we've got to track down, we've got to be able to secretly spy on you Americans, because you may be up to something, like you might be Democrats running for political office. Consider spin versus fact. This from the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. Spin. Bush administration saying that because of their illegal spying, they stopped possible terrorist attacks in the United States.
That's what George Bush said. He says, the activities I've authorized make it more likely that killers like these 9/11 hijackers will be identified and located, blah, 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 blah. Fact. This is from a former FBI official. Quote, the law enforcement and counterterrorism officials said the program had uncovered no active al-Qaeda networks inside the United States planning on attacks. That from the New York Times. Then from the FBI official, quote, there were no imminent plots not inside the United States, end of quote. Spin. They're only spying on people with clear links to al-Qaeda. Well, if that's the case, why don't they go before a judge? I think they're spying on people with clear links to John Kerry, frankly, or Al Gore. In fact, what we're learning now is that this thing started before 9/11. That George W. Bush had been intent on setting up a Stalinesque form of government right from day one. I was in Russia. Here, I say that on the air, and now I'll be, not that I'm not already right on the list. In any case, I was in Russia a couple of years ago. And I've been there a number of times, and I was there, this was the year, actually it was the week of their first elections, the very first elections, the first free elections ever held in Russia. And one of the people I was staying with told me this story, which is apparently now, since I've come back and I've told it to a few people, and they say, oh, I've heard that before, you know, so apparently this is like every Russian knows this story, right? One of those, it's like, you know, everybody in America knows that Jack Kennedy said, I'm a jelly donut in Berlin, right? In any case, Khrushchev was criticizing Stalin before the Politburo. Now, Khrushchev used to be in the Politburo, and he's criticizing Stalin because it was fashionable to do that after Stalin was dead. And somebody in the back of the room yells out, why didn't you say that when you were sitting back here? And Khrushchev looks around and he says, who said that? And absolute silence. Nobody answers. And he looks around and he says, who said that? Absolute silence. Nobody's even breathing. He pounds his fist on the dais. He says, who said that? Nothing. Nobody's even blinking. And he leans forward and cracks a little smile and he says, now you know why I didn't speak out when Stalin was standing here and I was sitting where you're sitting. And that's very much the world, it appears to me, that George W. Bush is trying to create for us. Terrified America. He certainly has cowed the press corps. If somebody in the press corps at a White House briefing, you know, asks a hard question, Helen Thomas asks a hard question, who said that? Oh, Helen Thomas, back in the room, says George W. Bush. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
In a perfect world, a woman's body is her own. In a perfect world, there's no melting ice cream cone. In a perfect world, there's no haute cuisine.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The Supreme Court today have they dodged the bullet? Have they set up something? Are they moving things around? What's going on with the Supreme Court ruling? We have with us the interim president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Karen Pearl. Karen, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Glad to have you here. Tell us what happened in the Supreme Court this morning.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled in the Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood of Northern New England case, and what they did is they sent the case back to the lower court. They said that they were not going to look again at the question of whether women's health and safety must always be paramount in any kind of abortion decision, and so they said to the lower court, figure this out. Either throw out the case because it was not the intention of the legislature to have it, an exception for women's health, and if they don't, then it's unconstitutional. Or it was the legislator's intent, put it in the law.
In other words, the Supreme Court is saying that if you're going to pass a law that in some way restricts abortions, even abortions to minors,
mm-hmm.
that law has to have some provision in it that will allow for going around those restrictions in the event the health of the pregnant woman or child is at risk.
That's right. The court is saying that women's health cannot be sacrificed to any kind of restriction. And
now,
so if it's a doctor's judgment that there is really some potential harm that will come to this person by not proceeding, right. The doctor can go forward.
Now, we're speaking with Karen Pearl, the interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PlannedParenthood.org, the website, by the way. When I was growing up, abortion was illegal in the United States.
Me too.
And I remember when I was going to high school, it was illegal, it was not uncommon to hear about people getting D&Cs or having to have surgery for hard periods or whatever, you know, and there was kind of this wink, wink, nod, nod that really what these were abortions that were being done legally, but they weren't being called that.
Uh-huh.
Are we going back to that day? Are we going to end up going back to that? And not to mention the back alley abortions. I mean, there was one girl in my high school who just vanished one day, and we later learned that she had died as a result of an illegal
right.
abortion.
Right.
I didn't know her personally, but I know who she was. You know,
mm-hmm.
Are we going back to those days? I mean, it seems to me like we're almost halfway there already.
Well, of course, we're very worried that we're on a pathway there. This decision does not put us back there. This decision actually says, for right now, nothing has changed. And that's a very good thing, and we are really relieved that the Supreme Court left in place protections for women's health.
Mm-hmm.
What we are looking at, however, in this Supreme Court nomination process that we're in right now, is the potential of putting somebody on the court who has written over and over and over again that, in his view, abortion should be overruled and that Roe v. Wade should not be the law of this land.
Right, that being Sam Alito.
And that is very dangerous.
Yeah,
that
being Sam Alito. Now, has Sam Alito, in his very public, and he uses the word proud to describe his opposition to abortion. He was proud of his opposition. In his public proclamations or in his job applications and whatnot, has he ever addressed the issue of whether a woman's life and health should be protected?
Actually, he has not addressed that specifically. What he has said is that Roe should be overturned, and while we're working to overturn it, we should do everything in our power to, in his words, mitigate its effects. In other words, do exactly what is happening now and chip right. away at Roe and make it harder and harder and harder for women to get access by putting in restrictions after restriction after restriction.
Right, like what we have right now where the only place in North Dakota where you can get an abortion is in South Dakota, and you can only get an abortion in that one city in South Dakota one day a week because the person flies in from Minnesota.
That's exactly right. So while Roe continues to stand as the law of this land, if you live in North Dakota or South Dakota, it doesn't feel that way to you very often.
Right, right. Now, I'm curious, the right-wing argument,
mm-hmm.
at least the right-wing legal argument that's made against Roe v. Wade, actually seems to me to have some cogency in that they suggest that when Roe v. Wade was decided, the justices divided pregnancy into three separate trimesters and came up with different rules for each of those three trimesters. And in doing that, they were legislating from the bench. They were creating specifics and details rather than deciding whether a broad policy was legal or illegal.
Well,
and
actually, in Roe, that's not what happened.
Okay.
In Roe, what happened is that the justices looked at the question of privacy,
mm-hmm.
believed that privacy extended to cover abortion,
mm-hmm.
and said that, however, in any of these decisions, the interests of the different parties must be considered. And so they said in Roe, pre-viability, they didn't say first or second trimester, they said pre-viability, a woman gets to make this decision.
Now, that's been broadly interpreted as first trimester, hasn't it?
Well, first and second trimester. It's been broadly interpreted that way. That's correct.
Okay.
But actually, that became clearer in later case law,
mm-hmm.
where the courts came back and said that even in the first and second trimester, you can put in restrictions, but
right.
any restriction must have an exception to preserve the life and the health of women.
Right. I understand all that, but here's where I'm going with this, and I'd love to get your take on this.
Sure.
If their suggestion that, and this is, I believe, Alito's argument, that the reason why Roe v. Wade should be overturned is because it is essentially the judicial branch doing the work of the legislative branch, why not go to the legislative branch and say, let's pass a law saying, you know, here are the rules, you know, pre-viability, no problem. Post-viability, you have to have, you know, one or two doctors sign off on it or something like that. I mean, let's come up with a set of standards that are actually legislatively enacted. Then the Supreme Court wouldn't have, they'd play no role in this.
Well, that argument holds if you believe that, in fact, what the Supreme Court was doing is acting as a legislature. We actually believe that what the Supreme Court was doing was looking at the Constitution, looking at the protections that the Constitution affords people in a broad range of decisions, and in the case of reproductive choice, finding in the Constitution that the right to privacy exists and that the right to privacy extends to women controlling the most personal and private decision, which is whether and when to become a parent.
Yeah.
And so we don't believe that was ever legislating from the bench. It was, in fact, looking at the law and what it covers, which is, in fact, the right to privacy.
Yeah.
And that is a right that people...
I understand and I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. I'm just saying, if you want to stop the whole right-wing machine in its tracks, wouldn't that be a way to do it?
Well, no, because I think what the right-wing machine would do is what we're seeing here, which is passing laws that are unconstitutional.
I see.
And so that...
So then you'd have a battle of legislators.
Well, yeah, and we have that right now, and that's why we were just in court in the AAP decision, because that was out of the legislature.
So Sam Alito presents I have been on this program every day now telling people to call toll-free 888-355-3588. It's a toll-free number for Congress. Ask for both of their senators, one at a time. If it's a Democratic senator, ask them to engage in a filibuster against this guy. If it's a Republican senator, ask them to break with their party and point out to them that Sam Alito is neither Republican nor conservative. He is a right-wing extremist. He is way out of the mainstream of even the Republican Party, and to not vote with their party to put him on the bench. And a lot of our listeners have been doing so and have been calling in. I'm wondering, you know, Karen Pearl, interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America, what else can we do?
Well, I think I want to say thank you to you, and I want to say thank you to all of your listeners who have done that, and any who haven't done it should get on the phone and do it, because so many of the rights that we care about are in jeopardy with Sam Alito's nomination. And so what we need to do is make sure that senators hear that the majority of their constituents do not want him on the bench, because they know that he will rule to overturn many fundamental rights, not just the right to choose or the right to abortion. But in our case, we're concerned about him around contraception, but we're concerned about civil rights, about family leave rights, about many things that people care about and that they count on in this country. So, you know, the senators have got to hear that their constituents really want them to hold the line and not put him on the court.
Karen Pearl, interim president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. We have about a minute left. Yesterday in the recent day before yesterday, I guess it is now, in the Supreme Court decision where the Oregon right to die with dignity is what it's called here in Oregon, law was upheld by the Supreme Court. We saw Justice John Roberts show his real stripes.
Right.
Do you think that his coming out as an ideologue rather than a conservative or whatever, you know, as somebody who's going to vote his ideology, might be giving pause to some Republicans with regard to Alito, because they're basically both making the same arguments?
Well, you know, I can't really comment on that case because it's out of the sphere of certainly what we really study here. But I do think that John Roberts aligning himself with Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, does show where he stands ideologically. That should give us great concern. And when people sort of say, well, then, the court really isn't going to be out of balance with Alito because, after all, Roberts just replaced another conservative justice, you know, what we can say is, well, Alito's replacing Sandra Day O'Connor. She was a swing vote. It matters.
Yeah, this is a big deal. This is a big deal.
And this Supreme Court.
And this battle is not over, my friends. Please stay with us on. Karen Pearl, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PlannedParenthood.org. Check out their website. Participate, join, contribute, be active, and don't forget to call your members of Congress. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you.
Joe Hill, the great wobbly labor organizer.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said
he. There you go. Oh, Joan Baez, what a beautiful voice. And no, labor is not dead. It's been under assault for 30 years, ever since, or what is it, 25 years since Ronald Reagan, 26 years now, I guess, since 1980, 81, 25 years, been under major assault, but labor is not dead. We are still here. Barbara in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Barbara, thanks for calling the program.
Hello, Tom. I'm just equally upset with both houses of Congress and both political parties, Republican and Democrat alike, for not exercising the restraint, the checks and balances on the president that could have prevented some of these abuses.
You're talking about, for example, spying on us?
Yes, sir. Mm. And the hubris put forth by Bush in his dealings, signing a bill and then saying, but I'm telling you right now I'm not going to obey this anti-torture measure.
Right, his signing statements. A brilliant idea brought to us in 1985, courtesy of one Samuel Alito.
Do you think that part of the problem is the incumbency in our Congress, where they learn to game the system once they've gotten in like Flynn and know how it works?
No, I think I think certainly there's probably some element of that to it, Barbara, but I think the biggest problem is that the Republican Party almost entirely and the Democratic Party perhaps half have been completely sucked into this corporatist worldview that what's good for corporations is good for America, that what's good for multinationals is good for America, that the world is flat, that if we just, you know, laissez-faire is the way it should go. And if you don't have a moral compass and if you don't believe that America is a community of communities and if you don't believe in a social contract and if you don't believe that the government is the servant of the people and also the force of the people, but rather you think that the marketplace should rule everything, then, you know, the whole idea of selling FaceTime with the president for $25,000 a pop starts to make sense. And I think it's a fundamental misapplication, misunderstanding of how a republic is supposed to work. I think that these guys just don't understand governments and governance and don't believe in it, a lot of them. And
have
so,
a good day, Tom.
And
thanks.
So, thank you, Barbara. And so, what you're left with is people who believe in cronyism. Brian in Newark, New Jersey. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mr. Hartman, how you doing?
I'm great. What's up?
Good to hear. Yeah, I'm just driving home. I called Hannity, Sean Hannity, yesterday. I listened to that radio show because I don't get anything else on a certain part of the New Jersey Turnpike.
You have my sympathies, Brian.
Yeah, well, no, it's intriguing, you know, to listen to what people think, and you know, and alarming at times as well. But I was listening to it, and he was talking about this domestic surveillance, and well, he called it domestic surveillance, and he said more or less that, you know, these are dangerous people that they're spying on, and that, you know, it's only...
Yeah, like PETA and the Quakers.
That's what I said to him. I called him up, and I said, you know, it's my understanding, do you think it's appropriate that they were spying on Quakers, you know, and there are people in a group, many of whom were Quakers in Florida, And he said he'd never heard such a thing. And I asked him, is it my understanding, is it fair to say that you had never heard at all? Is that what you're saying? And he said, yes, and then he hung up on me.
Yeah. Yeah, he just didn't want to acknowledge it. I mean, they certainly reported it on Fox, and that's tragic, Brian. It's really tragic.
That's pretty well documented. I don't know. Maybe it's not. For all I know, it could be, somebody just made that up, but it was reported.
No, that was a big story. It was in all the media. It's still out there. It was a big story.
16th, I think. I remember reading about it.
Yeah, there you go. You're absolutely right, Brian. And thanks for the call, and thanks for pointing it out. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. By the way, well said on describing the question brought to by that woman. About the culture,
you.
And I would just add to it, and by the way, that was a real hoot describing Khrushchev in the analogy.
Mm.
That was really funny.
Well, it is, except it's really tragic,
tragic,
what you have now are people who are scared to death. And when the people who work for George Bush who work for him in the White House have to get together and draw straws, and the person with the short straw is stuck with the job of telling him that people are dying in New Orleans, you know you've got a problem, and it's a Khrushchev-Stalin problem, I'm telling you.
Yes, and I just wanted to add to it. I know we're short on time here. To what you said about the culture, and I've talked about this, and it is, to me, it's the bottom line. It's this financial culture we're under here, this cesspool of thinking that just is so wrong. And you're alluding to it very, very well today about it. And it reminds me of the thought that I once read, if I may. There's no reason to be the richest man or woman in the cemetery. And I might add, there's no reason for America in so many ways to be the richest country in the cemetery. We can't do any business from there.
Right, yeah. And that's the direction we're heading tragically. Thank you, Gary. Steve in Pittsburgh, Mass. Springfield, Mass. Steve, we just have a few seconds left. Hey.
I enjoyed this segment with Karen Pearl.
Yeah.
Very much. And I was listening to you talk about how in the old days the D and C option for
right. dilation and something.
I want to stress, how classist this whole thing is, in that option was only available ever to middle class and upper middle
you're,
class.
You're absolutely right, Steve. You're absolutely right. You make an excellent, excellent point. And another reason why we've got to make sure that Sam Alito doesn't get on the Supreme Court. 1-888-355-3588, the phone number for your senator. Call your senator now. Thanks so much for being with us, my friends. Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.